Hello and welcome to GCSE English Revision Pod, the language pod. That's right. We are moving on, moving up.
And the truth is, people often forget that English GCSE is actually two GCSEs. It's like, you know, German and history. And so often when, and often some of our students at least, they revise literature, but they forget language.
Yeah, it's a common problem, isn't it? And it's a trend which is seen where people do a lot better.
Well, nationally, there is students do significantly better on literature than language. So we're going to do an episode on each question from each paper. We're going to start with language paper one.
Yep.
There is a handout, as always, which you can download from the bio. It has a link to our Gmail, our Google Docs. Mm-hmm. And on that handout, you'll find top tips for analysing language. You'll find the main language features that you can analyse for question two. You look at how to structure a response along with all of the examples we talk about today, the questions, they're printed in that handout.
It's all there. Everything you need is there, as it always is on Mr. Forster's fantastic handouts.
There's also a link to a second document, which is a revision guide we've put together for the whole of Language Paper 1. So if you want a little bit more detail, it's about 60 pages, so it's not one to dip into.
There's a solid document. I mean, you say we've put that together. I think that's incredibly generous of you to say
I may
say
have
that,
called it I? Mr. Forster's revision pack in a moment of hubris.
Very modest of you. Cool. So, yeah, just to be clear, we're not doing a whole paper, an episode. We're going to focus on a particular question per episode.
And this is because, unlike nearly all your GCSEs, language is skills-based. So we're focusing on the skill for that question, and we're going to really practice it.
And run you through a couple of examples, right?
Yeah, of course.
Okay, so language paper one, question two. This is a question of language analysis,
right? I mean, let's start with the big picture. Language paper one is 1 hour, 45 minutes. There's five questions for AQA. I should note here, this is relevant to other examples, but it's more tailored to AQA, because that is the example we study.
But the skills we're going to look at would be very transferable.
So if you're doing AQA, you've got about 12 to 15 minutes on this question, because it's worth 8 marks. So you don't want to be writing a huge amount. You could get full marks with one paragraph, but you may want to write two, depending on how much you can write in 12 to 15 minutes.
And be careful, because that 12 to 15 minutes is excluding reading time.
Yeah,
you know,
including
reading time.
So I think the most important advice before we get onto some examples is you've got to read the full question and answer the full question.
Yeah.
RTFQ and ATFQ.
Read the full question, answer the full question.
And the key skill on this is commenting on the effects of language. So you don't get any marks for feature spotting, polysyndetic sentences. What you want to look at is, why has the writer used the words that they used? What connotations, what meaning do those words have? And how do they create meaning? And what meaning do they create?
Yeah, essentially, how did the writer do what they've done? There will be a feeling, there will be a mood or some kind of vibe around what is being described.
Don't use the word vibe.
Don't use the word vibe, but do talk about how the writer created that vibe.
And so in the kitten pack, which is what the puppy pack, which is what I call my pack, it's got a picture of a puppy on page 3, there's a full list of terminology that we can use. But on the handout that I've got for today, there's a much shorter list. So before we get to that, things that I don't want you to do. Do not write about sentence structure, really, unless you're very confident. It's so hard to write about well, unless you know that you're a grade 9 student, you've got things to say about it. I wouldn't. I personally would just say don't write about it.
Yeah, it's very hard to make that work, isn't it?
Much easier to get high levels, talk about metaphors, similes, symbolism. I'd also say, don't write more than those 2 pages given. Like, some people will write on and on and on, they'll miss out a question at the end.
Yeah.
Don't write about techniques without looking at the effect. That's silly.
In fact, it would be better not to say what the technique
you
was.
You could get full marks saying the writer uses this word, the connotations of this word are.
Yeah.
You do not get marks of fancy terminology. And lastly, never ever use those evil phrases. It has a good effect, a big effect, or it makes the reader want to read on.
I love it when things make the reader want to read on.
Makes me want to vomit.
That's what I say when I go into a bookshop. I say, well, have you got anything that would make me want to read on?
And they say, get out.
Get out, you're not welcome
here.
So,
main things we're going to look at today, the connotations of words, that means what do we associate with a particular word, symbolism or figurative imagery, so metaphors, similes, personification, and then maybe specific things like zoomorphic metaphors or that we might have a little look at. So, before we look at an example, overall, I like to structure a response like this. I hate things like PE, I think they're quite simplistic.
Right.
So,
just going to jump in quickly and say, if it sounds like we're flying through, we kind of are, but Mr. Forster is religiously following the handout. So if you haven't yet, go and download the handout, as you will find it much easier to follow what we're saying.
And the real meat and potatoes of this episode is when we start talking about examples, which we're going to do in about 2 minutes. Yeah. So, how to structure a response. Start with a single sentence, just like you would on a literature exam, summing up what the writer is saying about the question. So if the question is on how the writer creates tension, give me an overview statement of how they create tension.
Yeah.
Then get in some quotations, embed them in full sentences, contextualize them, make it clear who's saying it, when, how does it appear. You might even want more than one quotation at this point.
You might.
But you might just want one if it's a really meaty one.
Write a lot about a little, relevant in this part of the exam.
Very, very much so. So the third part of my paragraph is I'll give like the basic analysis of what the overall effect is, but then I want to develop that analysis and go into more detail. I might link in a second quotation that's doing the same thing if it's an extended metaphor. I might give a different interpretation of it. We'll give you an example of what this means in a minute.
It's a bit of a case of not running before you can walk, I suppose. Yeah. It's good to start off with a kind of...
What's this quotation showing? Yeah. What's this simile, this metaphor, this thing doing?
What does it do, and then how does it do it?
And then finish by evaluating what is the writer doing? Why is the writer doing this? What are they establishing? What are they trying to get across?
Okay.
So that's all very complicated. Don't worry about it. Look at the sheet. But let's talk about some examples. So this first example, it's from... it's on your sheet. It's called Question 2, Example A. Mm-hmm. There's an extract from The Woman in Black by Susan Hill. You might have seen the film or even read the book. Let's not assume our readers are illiterate.
No, certainly not.
Sorry, listeners are illiterate.
Turns out you are the illiterate one.
The protagonist in this story spends the night alone in an isolated house, and the novel itself is a ghost story.
Right, so a little bit of contextual information about what the extract is and where it would be found.
Yeah, and you'll find that information at the top of the paper when you're reading your language paper.
Yeah, and actually it is quite important to read, isn't it? Because it will potentially... give you more understanding than you would have had otherwise. So don't just gloss over that. Actually make sure you are getting the full summary of what the thing is.
Indeed. The question for today is, how does Susan Hill use language to create a tense scene for the reader?
Right, so we know there's going to be tension there. Clearly the writer has created tension, or it wouldn't be in the question. How did the writer create this?
So we're looking for words with connotations of kind of fear. We're looking at metaphors, similes, imagery that creates a sense of fear, a sense of foreboding, or a sense of something that's ominous. These are some useful words we might want. So let's
creep up.
Let's read the extract. During the night, the wind rose. As I had lain reading, I became aware of the stronger gusts that blew every so often against the casements. But when I awoke abruptly in the early hours, it had increased greatly in force. The house felt like a ship at sea, battered by the gale that came roaring across the open marsh. Windows were rattling everywhere, and there was the sound of moaning down the chimneys of the house and whistling through every nook and cranny.
Oh, that's mighty tense.
So, What lines are jumping out straight away for you, and what might we say about them before we kind of look at how we could structure this?
Well, I'm thinking, I love that simile of the house feeling like a ship at sea.
I think there's a lot we could say with that.
Interesting, you've got connotations, because when we're at sea, you don't feel that same security, do you? When you're in a house, it's solid, it's on land, it's secure, but a ship at sea is rocked, it's at the mercy of the weather.
Particularly as, you know, I mean, to contextualise it, it's describing a night during a storm, and the idea that the house felt like a ship at sea implies that like a ship at sea could sink, you know, from the winds or the waves. He feels metaphorically that perhaps this house too could sink. It feels like a place that isn't safe. It seems to foreshadow the supernatural threats of the novel itself, doesn't it? It sets up this uneasy atmosphere that he feels like as a vulnerable sailor on a ship, vulnerable to the ocean, that he could sink.
And then you've got some lovely verbs in there, haven't you?
Yes, definitely. Like the gale came roaring across the marsh.
Mm-hmm.
It battered the house.
There was the sound of moaning down the chimneys and whistling through every nook and cranny. So the weather is almost being personified, would you say, in this extract?
Well, you can either kind of describe it as personified almost as a ghost, or the connotations of roaring certainly seem zoomorphic, like it's this threatening animalistic presence, like a monster.
Mm.
The idea that it's whistling through every nook and cranny, there's a sense of it chasing him through the house.
Right, and then there's an inescapability to it. Every nook and cranny, the adverb every is, sorry, the adjective?
Yeah.
Every is quite interesting there, because it suggests that there's no way he can get away from this force.
So I think what we've kind of given you there is a few examples that we could zoom in on. But it's much better to use fewer examples, but really analyse them in lots
Pull
of detail.
Apart.
And then the way I do this question, people say, how many paragraphs do you write, sir? And I say, you write how much you've got time for in 12 to 15 minutes.
Right.
So you write a paragraph and you think, oh, I've got 7 minutes left, I'll do a second one.
Mm-hmm.
The reason you do that, of course, the way the mark scheme works is the kind of the highest point you reach in your answer is the grade you get.
Yeah, so it's important to just keep going, isn't it? Don't cross stuff out, don't think that doesn't really work, I'm going to scribble it out. Just keep going, because the best thing that you write will be what you're judged on.
And this is why, I mean, you could get full marks for the single paragraph, but equally, if you've got time, why not write a second paragraph? It might be better than your first.
Yeah, well, exactly.
So let's start by having a little look then at the answer that I kind of picked out here. From the beginning of the extract, Susan Hill creates tension in her depiction of the weather. Mm-hmm. That's my topic sentence.
Yeah.
And it gives an overview for the question, doesn't it? We've got the weather is what she uses specifically to create tension.
Right, so you've developed on the question a little bit because the question didn't give you the weather. You've mentioned the tension, but you've said it's done through weather.
Avoid using vague things like the writer uses language techniques, because that makes it seem like you don't understand it. And the truth is you probably don't understand it if you're saying that. So once we've got that, we need some examples. This is apparent in her personification of how the wind rose and blew, roaring across the open marsh, moaning down all the chimneys and whistling through every nook and cranny.
Yeah.
So we decided to analyse those verbs that Mr. Galley picked out. And we've put it in a full sentence. You can see this on your sheet as well. But we've also immediately picked out a technique, personification.
Yeah.
So we're showing the examiner we're focusing on language. So a simple explanation of that, there is a suggestion here of the wind as a powerful and frightening force, even as a malign supernatural figure attacking the house.
Great, so you've got some good vocabulary in there. You've got the word malign meaning to damage, to be evil intent towards this thing. So straight away we're building on that answer.
But lots of students would stop there.
Right.
And if you stop there, you are not going to access the top levels.
No.
Because to access the top level, it's perceptive and detailed are the key words, level 4,
you
which
need
gets
to be
you to grade 9.
Zooming right in.
So let's zoom in on some words. So a word that I like that can signal you're doing that is specifically. Like, pick a word. And like, specifically, the verb roaring carries the zoomorphic idea of the storm as a monster getting ready to consume the protagonist. And in the idea of it whistling through every nook and cranny, Hill seems to suggest that it's somehow pursuing the narrator, chasing him through the house.
Mm.
So what you need to do when you're analysing words is explain, why did the writer use that particular word? What is that word associated with? What does it make you think of? And then you apply that back to the question, to his situation. Let's finish the paragraph then by coming back to what the writer's trying to say. What's the effect? Again, don't say this is effective or it makes us read on. Be clear. So this establishes a palpable, that means clear, tension at this moment in the novel, because the depiction of the weather is, of course, ultimately indicative of the narrator's sense of mind, of his sense of isolation and disquiet, staying alone in the house during the storm. It could also add to the idea of the house itself as being somehow haunted, threatened not just by the wind, but by harmful supernatural forces also.
Good, so you've kind of fused this idea of the weather, you've put it together with the supernatural and said, well, ostensibly, obviously, he seems scared of the storm itself, but then that makes us think, is this actually a supernatural element that's pursuing him?
And the reason we know that is because we read the context at the top, we know it's a ghost story.
Yeah.
So we can make the, even if we've not seen the film, we don't know anything about the book, we can guess that the weather seems here to prepare us for some kind of supernatural appearance.
That's all you need to do.
If you just wrote that one paragraph, you would get 8 out of 8 on this question.
Oh, that's quite arrogant of you to award yourself 8 out of 8 for that.
I think it would.
I'm sure it would.
I wouldn't. And the key things that we've done there again is we've identified specific words or phrases. We've looked at how at a technical level has the writer done this.
Mm-hmm.
But we've also explained in more detail what the effect of this is. Why did they compare them to these particular things?
Mm-hmm.
Should we look at a second example?
All right, brilliant. Let's crack on.
So this is example B. It's from a brilliant novel called The Yellow Birds by Kevin Powers. He's a genius of a writer. He was an Iraq war veteran and he wrote a novel about a man who comes back from Iraq and suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Similar to a lot of the poems that
like Remains in Power and Conflict.
Podcast, go and listen to them.
And this extract is the opening to the novel. And the question says, how does the writer use language to describe the war?
Okay.
Very simple. So we're looking for metaphors, similes, imagery, words that set up something about the war. It's some really hard vocab. But by the way, this is some beautiful writing. So let's read it. So he says, this is on your handout. The war tried to kill us in the spring. As grass greened the plains of Nineveh and the weather warmed, we patrolled the low-slung hills beyond the cities and towns. We moved over them and through the tall grass on faith, kneading paths into the wind-swept growth like pioneers. While we slept, the war rubbed its 1,000 ribs against the ground in prayer. When we pressed onward through exhaustion, its eyes were open and white in the dark. While we ate, the war fasted, fed by its own deprivation. It made love and gave birth and spread through fire.
It's wonderful writing.
Yeah, I mean, I can't read today, so I'm totally illiterate.
That's all right.
What stuff's jumping out at you straight away? What language do you use to describe war? What might we look at? What quotations?
Well, first of all, the most interesting thing, I suppose, or one of the very interesting things is even in that first line, it's the war who tried to kill them. It's not the enemy.
Yeah, war's personified, isn't
war
it?
War is its own entity. It's a living, breathing
again,
thing.
Like the storm in the last example, the war's personified as almost a monster.
Yeah.
So the brilliant bit, that's it's extended personification. If you say extended, it just means it goes on for a while.
Yeah.
So it rubbed its 1,000 ribs against the ground in prayer. Mm-hmm. Do you have 1,000 ribs, Mr. Gelly?
I don't
either.
No.
This suggests this war is something massive, something huge, a monstrous creature.
Yeah.
Its eyes are white and open in the dark. Are your eyes white?
And certainly not all the way through. No, that's a horrible
It's quite a creepy, a sinister image, isn't it? It seems like a monster out of a horror film.
Yeah.
And the idea of it spreading through fire, giving birth through fire, is quite... you know, what are the connotations of fire?
Yeah, and its ability to reach out, perhaps unchecked by man, but also the juxtaposition of the idea of the womb making love and giving birth, something as destructive as war, and yet having somehow the ability to make love is quite an interesting image, I think.
Yeah, well, I think it's quite disturbing, isn't it? It's the idea that war is like reproducing.
Yeah.
That fire is, that rather than being an act of a beautiful act of creation, this is destruction
spreading.
Self-serving
act of creation, self-preservation.
So I think straight away this paragraph is going to be on the personification of the war.
Yeah.
That's what I'm writing. So my topic sentence is, in the opening paragraph, Kevin Powers personifies the war as a disturbing and monstrous figure.
Right, nice.
Straight away. So we're being specific. So we're not just saying he describes war in many different ways. No, we're saying he's a personification to make it seem monstrous.
Yeah, clear. So, here's what he does, here's why he does it.
Then we're going to get some quotations, some examples. He begins by emphasising how the war tried to kill us before extending this personification with the terrifying depiction of its eyes, which were white and open in the dark, as it rubbed its 1,000 ribs against the ground in prayer. And the frightening idea contained in the alliterative oxymoron, that it fasted, fed by its own deprivation.
Good. So alliterative, meaning both words start with the same sound, and oxymoron, of course, meaning the two words shouldn't go together.
They contradict each other.
Mm.
So, again, you don't get the marks for the terminology. And we've not really done much analysis yet, so we've not really picked up many marks yet. We're doing the basic stuff before we get to the fireworks.
We've set ourselves up. You've put the ball onto your better foot. You're looking at the goal.
You're getting ready to shoot at the goal, but you can still miss it. Mm. So we now start with our simple analysis. The abstract noun deprivation here, like the monstrous nature of this image conjured up in Powers' metaphors, sets up this image of war as something beyond reason, beyond comprehension. Like the beast of the apocalypse from Revelation. That's just me showing off, you know. That's just a biblical allusion. So you don't need to worry about that last bit. But the point is here, the word deprivation shows that this seems like a monster.
Right.
But I think more importantly, this association can also be seen in the semantic field of the polysyndetic list. That just means it says and, which ends the first paragraph. From the idea that the war made love and gave birth and spread through fire, it's possible to see its association with hell.
Right.
So the main analysis is that it seems associated with hell.
That it seems fiery, that it seems all damnation and burning.
But what I'm going to do here is show you how you can actually go into more detail by giving a different interpretation. Yeah. Just like we've done with our literature podcast, you can say it's something different. So I say, nevertheless, what is important here is not simply its terrifying nature, but the idea that war is personified as being specifically Muslim. It's fasting, it's praying, with its chest to the ground.
Right.
So this takes our analysis a little bit further. This is quite a perceptive idea, that war is not just a monster, it's a Muslim monster. So then we can finish by saying, therefore, despite the poetic register, the elaborate language, in this opening description, we see more than the narrator's horror at the Iraq War. We can also infer his prejudice against those that he's fighting.
Right, so that would be the quite subtle analysis, wouldn't it, that through this language, the writer is showing not only this monstrous perception of war, but also he's judging the war to be the kind of fault of his enemy, right? Yeah. That's the monster he's fighting against.
And that's where we really nail our level four, our top level answer.
Right.
We've picked out quotations, we've picked out techniques of language, we've looked at the associations of words, but we've given a couple of different interpretations, we've gone into a little bit of detail.
Yeah.
So it's that, again, single paragraph that could get you 8 out of 8.
And indeed, they'd only really need to go into the monstrous aspect of it to potentially hit the top 8, wouldn't they? If they did that first bit really you would be there without going into the prejudices of the speaker. Yeah. You could get that just from the monstrous depiction of the war.
Listen, the most important thing to remember about this exam is you say a lot about a little.
Yeah.
You go into lots and lots of detail about a quotation. So there's one more example, which you might want to do yourselves, but we won't read you a model answer, but we'll set up some things you might want to analyse.
Yeah.
And why don't you have a go?
Sounds good.
So this is an extract from Brighton Rock by Graham Greene. It's set in 1938. In the popular seaside town of Brighton.
Great town.
And Hale, who's a journalist, he's playing the part of Colly Kibber. He works the Daily Messenger newspaper, and he gives out cards for prizes to the holiday crowd. But something else is on his mind. So his job is... it's a bit like, they sometimes do this on radio shows today. If anyone reads the newspaper and understands the clues, they find out where he is, and if they find him, he gives them money.
They get surprised, and he's play, and he's called Colly Kibber, yeah. Right? That's his
that's his newspaper name, but his real name is Hale.
Yeah.
And what we're, the question we're doing is, how does the writer use language to describe Brighton on that day?
Mm.
So the question isn't really on Hale. I mean, Hale's mentioned, that's why I mentioned his name. But the question is on Brighton. So we're looking for, what is Brighton like? What kind of place does it seem?
Mm-hmm.
What words, similes, metaphors, imagery can we see?
So we're going to leave that to our listeners.
So we'll read it, and then we'll pick out a few quotations, and we'll leave you to write your own paragraph.
Sounds good.
So,
sounds good.
They came in by train from Victoria every 5 minutes, rocked down Queen's Road standing on the tops of the little local trams, stepped off in bewildered multitudes onto fresh and glittering air. The new silver paint sparkled on the piers. The cream houses ran away into the west like a pale Victorian watercolour. A race in miniature motors, a band playing, flower gardens in bloom below the front, an aeroplane advertising something for the health in pale vanishing clouds across the sky. It had seemed quite easy to Hale to be lost in Brighton. 50,000 people besides himself were down for the day, and for quite a while he gave himself up to the good day, drinking gins and tonics wherever his programme allowed.
Sounds like a nice day.
I mean, I'm straight away thinking the first paragraph's more interesting for language than the second.
Yes.
The second's just telling us what he's doing.
Mm.
Whereas, as we said with literature, it's often symbols, similes, metaphors, they're often the easiest place to start.
Yeah.
Because they force you to go into detail. Mm-hmm. So is there anything that's jumping out at you, Mr. Gully, that you'd like to analyse straight away? About Brighton, how Brighton's described.
Well, I think, first of all, the flesh and glittering air. I think the connotations of the word glittering might be interested, especially when
you
put
said
together.
Flesh, fresh.
The fresh and glittering air, sorry.
Flesh and glittering air are disturbing.
Especially when combined with the sparkling silver paint. Then, of course, you've got this great long list of the various things that are to be seen.
Yeah, so, I mean, let's start on this. So the connotation of glittering and sparkled, these are things that imply it's a city, it's a town filled with light, filled with beauty. And the long list of attractions, again, is very sensual. It focuses on the colours, the silver paint, the cream houses.
Mm.
And it's the band playing, the flower gardens in bloom. It's appealing to the different senses, the sense of smell, the sense of hearing, the sense of sight.
Yeah, and also the language that describes the amount of people who are there and the way they're behaving is quite interesting.
So it's depicted in a very positive way.
Yeah.
But I think perhaps the most interesting one to zoom in on in a bit of detail is the idea that the houses look like a pale Victorian watercolour.
Right.
Because the connotations of a Victorian watercolour painting, it suggests that it almost looks like a work of art.
Yeah.
It looks like something created by an artist, something that's beautiful. So this ties in with the idea that the day is perhaps so perfect. It seems almost framed by its kind of artistic beauty.
Hmm.
And that certainly seemed to set up Brighton as a positive place.
Very
obviously,
nice.
If you read the whole piece, you'd realise that Hale fears to be murdered.
Yeah.
So actually, you could talk about, therefore, there's this juxtaposition between this beautiful setting and the fears that Hale has.
And that would be probably quite useful for a question three.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you definitely touched upon that in question three. So we'll leave you there. If you look in the kitten pack, there's actually some examples from the exam board of 2 out of 8, 4 out of 8, 6 out of 8, and 8 out of 8 for
this. Nice. So it might be worth writing your answer, then going and looking at those and seeing where you think your answer fell.
So to sum up, question two is actually not as hard as people think. It's the same skills you've been doing for English literature.
Mm-hmm.
You need to decide forensically which are the best quotations to analyse. I often would jump at similes, metaphors, symbols.
Yep.
Or words with really interesting connotations.
Mm, especially multiple connotations, if there's anything that...
That's the dream, isn't it? Then I would start with a thesis that's more specific than the question. So it goes into a specific aspect of the question. Pick in a few quotations. You know, if it's one, you could have one amazing quotation, but realistically, you might need a couple to look at.
Yeah.
Couple of quotations, then give your simple explanation, what's the overall effect, zoom in on more detail, which are the interesting words or phrases, what are the connotations they have, how does that link to the character or theme being discussed,
and really pull it apart, you know, really forensically dissect those words.
And then right at the end, come back to the writer's purpose. Why is the writer doing this? What are they trying to establish? What's the effect of it? And
like a little micro essay, really, isn't it?
It is like a mini essay. This is these are the skills you've done on all of your literature texts.
Yeah.
So that's question two.
So I think we're about
that's
done.
That's all I got to say about that.
Very good.
It's a quote from Forrest Gump.
Very good here, indeed. Right, so please let us know how you get on with that. Our email address is...
englishrevisionpod@gmail.com.
You can follow us on Twitter @grevisionpod. And as ever, make sure you have gone to the bio of this podcast. You have downloaded all the materials that we have attached. And we will see you next time when we will have a look at question 3.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Have a brilliant day.